Talk number two is called Give Your Life Away. I'm going to tell you all the same things I just said, because you didn't get them the first time. And I have a three-point outline. Number one is give up your right to yourself. Number two is take up the cross. And number three is follow. Because I do want you to get it through your heads. Okay? Another illustration of a woman who's had a very deep influence in my life was Amy Carmichael, who gave her life away. Before she was 20, she believed that God wanted her to remain single for the rest of her life. When I wrote her biography, I came across all sorts of interesting data, and it appeared to me that she had had probably at least three proposals, but had believed from her teenage years that God was calling her to remain single, which she did, not realizing that God would someday make her the mother of more than 700 children in South India. She gave up the very effective traveling evangelism that she did for the first 6 years, traveling by bullock cart, which is probably the most uncomfortable method of travel in the world. It's a wooden cart pulled by two bullocks, cows with long horns. It feels as though the wheels are square, because Lars and I took a 10-minute ride in a bullock cart when we were over there, and 10 minutes was about 9 minutes too many, so uncomfortable. But it was while she was itinerating with the gospel in various villages in South India that she learned about the terrible traffic of little babies that were committed to the Hindu temples for the purposes of prostitution. She was horrified, and she began to pray that God would enable her to rescue some of those babies. And over the years, God did enable her to rescue as many as 700 of those children. So she gave up what the world would call spiritual work, evangelizing, and she became a mother. A mother gives her life away. I told you last night about my own mother's attitude about her not having a life of her own. Of course she had a life of her own. She had six children, but she had given herself to God. And any mother, even a non-Christian mother, realizes, if she's got common sense, that mothering means sacrifice. It means sacrifice for the 9 months before the baby's born. In certain amount of ways, you may have more or less of morning sickness and other things which make life more difficult. And then when you go through labor and birth, it means pain, it means suffering. And there's a certain amount of fear involved. Sacrifice. But then, of course, once the baby is born, that's just the beginning, isn't it? My mother said she had the idea that when her six children grew up, she could somehow cross them off her list. And she said, I discovered that I not only couldn't cross them off the list, but the list was doubled because we all got married. And then she had to pray for all those in-laws, and then she had to pray for all the grandchildren. And then she began praying for great-grandchildren. Giving up her right to herself as a mother, as a grandmother, as a great-grandmother. Breastfeeding is certainly a very clear illustration, a human, ordinary illustration of sacrifice. My life for yours. Isn't it amazing that God ordained that we should be life givers? Now, dear Miss Cumming, being single all her life, she never nursed a baby, but she nursed all of us. Amy Carmichael was a mother to 700 children. She had to make the same kind of sacrifices, minus the carrying of the child and the actual labor process and the breastfeeding. But there was sacrifice, sacrifice, sacrifice every day. The offering up of this body, and God has only given you one body. And Paul says in Romans 12, I beseech you therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, that ye present your bodies a living sacrifice, holy, acceptable unto God, which is your reasonable service, it says in the King James, and I love a more modern translation that says an act of spiritual worship. This physical being becomes in the offering an act of spiritual worship. Just as the vessels in the tabernacle in the Old Testament, although they were made of gold and bronze, things which were often used to make many other things that had nothing to do with the tabernacle, but when they were consecrated to God, they became holy vessels. It wasn't the gold that made them holy. It wasn't the bronze that made them holy. It's not the dishes you wash that make you a holy person. It is the washing the dishes, the doing the laundry, the cleaning out the closet as an offering for Jesus Christ. Giving your life away. A woman's body is a chalice, a cup. We are made to bear, to carry, to nurture. And the physical arrangements that God has made remind us, up to a certain age, we are reminded every month of sacrifice. Blood means sacrifice. It's very significant all through the Old Testament. And God so ordained that you and I be reminded over and over and over again of life coming out of death. And when the life is not conceived in the womb, then there has to be the death, getting rid of the blood. And then you start over again. So I think that it can't be nearly so vivid for men as it is for us women. The whole question of physical, personal, self-giving. Men are not excusable, of course, in not recognizing that they, too, are meant to be bearers of the life of Jesus. A passage in the scriptures that came alive for me when I was living in the jungle after my husband was killed. I was living in a very remote place with the tribe that had killed my husband. And my daughter was 3 years old at the time, and we lived in exactly the same kind of a house that the Indians lived in. You would hardly call it a house. It was six poles with a thatched roof. There were no walls, no floors, no furniture, no doors, no windows. I had a hammock strung between two poles. My daughter slept on a slab of split bamboo on the floor, the mud floor, right partly under my hammock. And next to my hammock, I had a fire, which I kept going 24 hours a day, as did all the rest of the people in that clearing. But there were many long evenings when everyone else had gone to sleep, when I would sit there in my hammock by my fire and ponder the strange sovereign will of God in taking my husband in his attempt to reach those people with the gospel, and then miraculously and unexpectedly enabling me to make contact with those people about a year and a half later. And here I was actually living with them. But I couldn't speak a word of their language. And you know what it's like, you who are foreigners who came to this country, and you Americans who visit foreign countries, you know that you never feel so helpless as when you don't know the language. Well, usually you're going to a language for which you can get tapes and books and interpreters and teachers. I had none of the above with the Alcas. They had no idea that there were any other languages in the world. They thought anybody with any brains spoke their language. So when they heard me and Valerie talking together, they figured that we must be just talking a lot of gobbledygook. All I could do was listen and try to imitate and write down what I heard and then try to figure out what in the world it meant. And so in the evening one night, I was sitting there in my fire. Everyone else had gone to sleep. I'm sitting beside my fire. And I was reading, which I couldn't do very often because I didn't have any lights other than candles, which were very hard to come by. And I read this passage, 2 Corinthians 4, verse 6. God, who said, "Light shine, let light shine out of darkness," made his light shine in our hearts to give us the light of the knowledge of the glory of God in the face of Jesus Christ. But we have this treasure in earthen vessels, or in jars of clay, to show that this all-surpassing power is from God and not from us. We are hard-pressed on every side, and that's the way I felt, but not crushed. We are perplexed. I certainly was that, but not in despair. Persecuted. Now, I was not persecuted, but Paul was, but not abandoned, and struck down but not destroyed. We always carry around in our body the death of Jesus. We always carry around in our body the death of Jesus. Do you know what that means? Have you thought about that? Why do we do this? He says, so that the life of Jesus may be revealed in our body. For we who are alive are always being given over to death for Jesus' sake. And that being given over to death is what we were talking about this morning. We are always being given over to death for Jesus' sake. Why? So that his life may be revealed in our mortal body. So then death is at work in us and life in you. Death went to work in the Chinese farmer, and life sprang up for his enemy. Death went to work when Amy Carmichael had to give up her evangelistic work, and life sprang up for all those children. Death went to work in dear Miss Cumming, wealthy lady used to servants, who became a servant. And life sprang up in us girls. Many of you are single. Are you thinking all the time, is God going to give me a husband? Maybe he's given you several. And for one or the other reason, you don't have a husband anymore. And you're sitting there thinking, well, Elizabeth Elliott, she's got three of them. She's had three of them. And one girl said to me, I don't understand why the Lord gives you three husbands and he hasn't even given me a date. And they asked me, why? Why did God give you three husbands? How do I know? I don't know. I thought it was a miracle that I got married the first time. I wasn't a popular girl. I wasn't pursued by the guys in either high school or college. But we have a sovereign Lord who knows exactly what he's doing, don't we? And so I've been learning ever since those years with the Alka Indians what this means, that death must go to work in us in order that there be life in others. And so I challenge all you who are single, stop worrying or being obsessed with the idea, when is God going to give me a husband? Maybe he's not going to give you a husband. People always want me to say, well, one of these days the Lord is going to give you a husband. How do I know? It's just as mysterious to me why he doesn't give you one as it is that he gave me three. It's none of our business, is it? God knows exactly what is best for each one of us. Now, I could not be doing what I'm doing today if it weren't for Lars Grin. I would not be doing what I'm doing today if Jim Elliott had not been killed. Because that was what precipitated me into writing a book. I was going to be a jungle missionary for the rest of my life. I never dreamed of being anything but a jungle missionary, doing linguistic work. Well, God saw to it that a whole lot of things which were far from my imaginations came to pass. Do you trust him? Have you given your life away and said, Lord, here I am. Do anything you want with me. What did Mary say when the angel came with that piece of news? She said, behold, the handmaiden of the Lord. Let it happen as you say. Be it unto me according to thy word. Jesus echoed those words, didn't he, in the Garden of Gethsemane. Not my will, but thine be done. And it was because Mary said yes to God, that Jesus was born. Mary said yes to God. There's an old legend that perhaps that angel who came to Mary's house with that stunning piece of news had had to make many stops trying to find a girl who would say yes. Instead of, well, but what about me? What about my plans? Mary didn't say, what about Joseph? What will I tell my parents? What will the people in the town think? No objections, no hesitations, just behold the handmaiden of the Lord. Do with me anything you want. Are you scared to say that? Does it terrify you to think of what God might require? A girl came up to me one time, she said, Mrs. Elliott, it really scares me when I hear your testimony. She said, I say, well, what do you mean? Why does it scare you? Well, I mean, like, you know, well, it's just really scary to hear that testimony. What's scary about it? I say, well, but, I mean, like, what if God did to me what he did to you? And I say, well, what did God do to me? Well, you know, like, he took away two of your husbands. And I said, God has never done anything to me that wasn't for me. It takes a while for us to realize that, doesn't it? Of course. I didn't know what God was doing. But I learn it from this passage, and I have to keep reviewing it over and over again. We carry death in our body so that the life of Jesus may be revealed. It is no to myself and yes to God. Now, I cannot think of a more crucial area in which these three principles are going to be lived out in our lives than in marriage. Now, before I go on to marriage, let me encourage you who are single to be spiritual mothers. Instead of worrying about whether God's going to give you another husband or a husband, ask the Lord to give you the grace to give your life away for somebody else. You know, there are desperately needy women in the world, perhaps younger than you are, perhaps not younger than you, but perhaps they don't know anything about Jesus Christ. My life has been greatly blessed by these spiritual mothers who were single. Amy Carmichael was single. Miss Cumming was single. My friend Catherine Morgan was a widow practically all of her life. She had four little children. The oldest was 5 and a half when Catherine's husband was killed. And she is still a missionary in Colombia, South America, at the age of 88. She's been there about 65 years. Spiritual mothers, you're not exempt because you're single. Ask God to teach you what Isaiah 58:10 means. It's a wonderful verse for those who are feeling sorry for themselves, wondering why God doesn't do this or that. That verse speaks of pouring yourself out for other people, and then the Lord will make your life a watered garden. Now, let's get right down to the nitty-gritty on what it means to give up your right to yourself, take up your cross in marriage. You walk down that aisle, your eyes glued to that most wonderful man in the whole world, and you knew you were getting a prize package. About 24 hours later, you find out that he's a surprise package. And I don't care how long you may have known him. You may have known him since kindergarten, but you didn't know all that there was to know about this man, and it begins to be unraveled. But you have already made a solemn and irrevocable promise before God and witnesses that you are going to love, honor, and I hope you didn't leave out the word, obey this man. And it's going to be for better or for worse, in sickness and in health, for richer or for poorer. Now, of course, you're not expecting it to be worse and sickness and poorer. But it's probably going to be all three. And so, from day one, God expects a sinful man and a sinful woman to live together in harmony 365 days a year. And there are going to be some tensions, aren't there? And some surprises. And God is going to be speaking to you in that still small voice and saying, I know what I'm doing. This is my will for you now. This man, in this place, with or without this job, whatever the situation may be, here is where I want you to learn the principle that death has to go to work in you. Let's look at this second principle. Take up your cross, which means acceptance. The giving up your right to yourself is relinquishment. The taking up of the cross is acceptance. It is Mary's word, yes, Lord. I will receive this man who stands in the place of Christ in my home. And your husband is your head, not because he's smarter than you are, not because he's better looking than you are, not because he's bigger and stronger than you are, and not because he's more spiritual than you are. He might be all of those things, or he might be none of them. But he is your husband because he has been assigned a divine office which represents Christ. And your office represents the church, the bride of Christ. That's why we are to submit to our husbands. Because there is a deep mystery being enacted here, the mystery of Christ and the church. Christian marriage, human marriage, represents that mystery. We're not going to understand it all. We're going to rebel against it in our sinful human nature. But God has certainly taken me through some deep lessons because I've been married to three very, very different men. Believe me, very different. My first husband was 1 year younger, and I had known him in college, and I mean, he was just the perfect man in the whole wide world. And, of course, he and I had 27 months of marriage after waiting 5.5 years for each other. I never expected to be married again. I just knew that there wouldn't be any possibility that I could ever love anybody the way I loved Jim Elliot. And 13 years later, when I was in my 40s, along came Addison Leach. And Addison Leach was a very different kind of a man. He was 18 years older than I. He was a PhD, he had been the president of a seminary and vice president of a college and the dean of another college, brilliant speaker, brilliant writer, wrote about 8 books. Jim, 1 year younger, Ad, 18 years older, and Lars, I'm not going to tell you how many years younger, but you certainly can see that he's younger. And so the Lord is teaching me. This is the man to whom you have to submit now, and I have to submit in different ways than I had to submit to Jim and Ad. Be careful how you define your own cross. It's easy to think that it is something that you cannot avoid. People often say, well, I guess that's just my cross. Something that's happened, perhaps they have to take care of a handicapped person or a senile old person. Well, this is my cross. It's easy to think that the cross is something that you cannot avoid. The true cross is avoidable. God is asking us to will to do His will. You can say, I will not take up that cross. I refuse that cross. You would never say that, of course, in so many words. But deep down in your heart, that's what you're saying. You are refusing a cross that Jesus may be offering to you. A glad yes may transform a grudging got to. A glad yes may transform a grudging got to. And that thought came to me just recently through a letter that a young woman had written to me telling me that she had grudged the fact that she had to submit to her husband. Because husbands are fallible, aren't they? They're not always right. They may make very big mistakes. And I think one of the main reasons that women refuse to submit to their husbands is fear. They're just so afraid that if we do what he says, then this and this and this are going to happen. They're just going to be disasters. And so they take it upon themselves to disobey God. They refuse that cross. And they will not make the offering. This woman was sort of running the show. It's a lady that wrote to me. Her husband sort of collapsed as a wimp and just let her do everything. Well, that's what happened back in the Garden of Eden, wasn't it? Eve was the one with the idea of eating the fruit, and Adam said, fine, if that's what the little lady wants, that's what the little lady's going to get. And he wimped out. This lady said, I realized that I had to step back, start honoring my husband because he is my head and he represents Jesus Christ. Another time I was speaking in Massachusetts, and I mentioned Matthew 25:40, which says, inasmuch as you've done it for one of the least of these, my brothers, you have done it for me. And Jesus was talking in that particular context about a small child, pointing out that this is one of his brothers. That's the principle on which all of Mother Teresa's work was based. These derelicts in the gutter, these dying people, almost corpses, that she would go out and pick up and take back to her hospital. She said, when Malcolm Muggeridge asked her, why do you do this? She said, because we want to do for them what we would do for Jesus if we could see him. And God is asking us to do for our husbands what we would do for Jesus if we could see him. And this lady had just made it, she and her husband had agreed that their marriage was absolutely untenable any further. They had gone through 33 absolutely miserable years, and they had agreed that it was time to get a divorce. And she made the mistake of coming to that church that day when I was speaking, and she went out of there in a rage. Elizabeth Elliot's got to be out of her tree. She's telling me that I'm supposed to treat him as though he were Jesus Christ. How in the world can I treat this bum as if he were Jesus Christ? And she said as she was driving home, she was thinking it over and thinking, it's ridiculous, it's outrageous, and it's impossible. But I'm going to try it. I'm going to try it. She got home. She found her husband sitting, she said, as usual, like a mummy on the sofa, watching TV. She said, I hated that scene. But she said, I walked in and I said in a gentle voice, honey, could I speak to you for a minute? And for the first time in 33 years, he turned off the TV to listen. Well, she said, I didn't know what to say. What do you say when it's Jesus sitting on the sofa? She had a long list of things that she thought she was going to say about why they shouldn't be married anymore. But the list was completely transformed, and she began confessing her sins against him. And she didn't get very far with her list before he said, wait a minute, honey. I've got a few things of myself, of my own, to confess. Well, to make a long story short, she said, our marriage has been totally transformed. She said, we are in love, Elizabeth, as we were never in love, even when we were engaged. Give up your right to yourself and take up the cross, which sometimes means an apology, an acknowledgement that you were wrong. You may go to that person and they don't want to hear your apology and they're not going to forgive you, but you are still going to accept that answer. It is a cross, but you take it up. We are asked to give our flesh and blood, our daily life, our thoughts, our service to one another. We are asked to give our affections, our intellect, our gifts, our love, We're speaking still about relationship with a husband. We are asked to give him love when he doesn't deserve it, when he doesn't feel like receiving it. And sometimes that love means keeping your mouth shut. Quite often, doesn't it? I was talking the other day with a group of girls in California, almost all of them married, I think. And one of them raised this question. She said, Elizabeth, she said, when you get into a conversation with your husband, which is only meant to be a conversation, and she said, you can see that it is going to move toward an argument. She said, I don't want it to be an argument. I don't want to argue with him. I just want to have a friendly discussion. What do you do? Well, she was hitting me at a very sore place because I am a born arguer. I was a champion debater in high school and college. My mother used to say to me, Betts, don't argue with me. I can't answer your questions. Well, it hit me right down where I lived. And I said, I'm not sure I can answer that question because it happens quite often. I get into what I want to be a friendly conversation with Lars. Suddenly I find that I'm instantly tempted to come up with what I think is an absolutely perfect argument that he will not be able to say no to. I'm sure I can win. And so when she said, what do you do? I said, shut up. That's the best thing I know. Just shut up. Don't say all the things that you think are so brilliant and so needed. You give him your love, you give him your waking and your sleeping, your ordinary human joys and your sorrows. Now, don't give him too many of those. No man is interested in hearing how you feel about everything. Keep your feelings to yourself. Just choose to feel good about him. Choose to love him. And that is what it means to bear Christ in the world. We're not going to be bearing Christ in the world, accepting death in our body and life in those whose lives we impact. We will not be in a position to do that until we're prepared to take up the cross. Christ lives in me. And the life which I now live in the flesh, I live by the faith of the Son of God who loved me and gave himself for me. Has it occurred to you to think a whole lot about Mary's predicament and what it meant for her to be the mother of the Son of God? I was thinking the other day about the fact that she was never asked to become extraordinary. We don't know much at all about Mary, do we? Do you know the last thing that Mary ever said that's recorded in Scripture? The very last words that the Scripture has were at the first miracle, when Jesus was at the wedding of Cana, and the servants came and said, we don't have any more wine, and Mary realized that this was an embarrassment for the host, and so she said to the servants, do anything he tells you, speaking of Jesus. Do anything he tells you. We don't know anything else that Mary ever said. We do know that she stood at the cross of Jesus when he was being crucified, not lay in a sobbing heap at the foot of the cross, but stood. A woman of strength, character, trust, and total self-giving. She was not asked to become extraordinary. She raised this little child in that little out-of-the-way place, which was considered a laughable place. Nazareth is, can anything good come out of Nazareth? The disciples had said. She was not set apart from other women in any way, or to make a hard and fast rule of life, or to compile a manual of self-mortifications or heroic resolutions. You and I are not going to be asked to make a manual of self-mortifications. God will see to it that we have sufficient mortification. That means dying to ourselves. You understand the word mortician, mortuary. These are derivatives of the same word, aren't they? They all mean death. Mortifications. Death to myself. We won't, most of us, be allowed to do anything like that. God wants us to live ordinary lives in an extraordinary way, bearing the life of Christ in our mortal bodies. We are asked to be broken bread and poured out wine. And of all the chapel speakers that I heard when I was a student at Wheaton College, very few are still in my memory. Very few things that any of them said. But I have never forgotten what one chapel speaker said. If your life is broken when given to Jesus, it may be because pieces will feed a multitude when a loaf would satisfy only a little boy. If your life is broken when given to Jesus, it may be because pieces will feed a multitude when a loaf would satisfy only a little boy. One writer said, if impatient thou let slip thy cross, thou wilt not find it in this world again. If, comma, impatient, comma, thou let slip thy cross, refuse to carry it, in other words, thou wilt not find it in this world again. God is presenting the cross to you in a form which perhaps you're not recognizing. Some way in which he wants you to accept suffering. That's what the cross was for, wasn't it? When Jesus took up the cross, it was the acceptance of suffering. I don't know what form that suffering may take, but God does. And so he's asking you, will you accept this pain, this difficulty, this strange thing that has happened? My very first year as a missionary, I was working in the western jungle of Ecuador, single. I was not even engaged to Jim at that time. Jim was working way over on the eastern side of the Andes with another tribe in the eastern jungle. And I had four huge blows to my faith in that very first year as a missionary. The first was the murder of the man who was my linguistic helper. He was a Christian. He was the only man in the world that spoke both the Colorado Indian language, which was what I was supposed to be reducing to writing, and Spanish. So he and I could converse in Spanish, and he could interpret into this Indian language. So he was indispensable. And there was nobody else in the whole world that knew those two languages except Don Macario. His name was Macario. And he was shot to death just a few weeks after he and I had begun our work. And I looked at that corpse with the hole in the head, and I said, Lord, why? And I looked into an abyss. No answer, no light, no echo, except that the Lord is constantly saying to us, will you trust me? Just trust me. I do know what I'm doing. I didn't make a mistake. Well, before that year was over, I had watched a mother die in childbirth. Then, toward the second half of that year, I had a proposal at long last from Jim Elliott. He asked me to marry him. But he said, I'm not going to marry you until you learn Quechua. So I had to learn Spanish. Then I had to learn the Colorado language. Now I was going to have to learn Quechua if I was going to accept his proposal. I didn't think it was too high a price to pay for a man like Jim Elliott, so I said yes. That meant that I had to leave the western jungle and go over the Andes into the eastern jungle on another station, not where Jim was, but start the study of the Quechua language. I had not been there very long when I heard my fiancé's voice on the radio. He was on another station. He was announcing that the entire station on which he'd been working that year had just gone down the Amazon in a flood. All the buildings. He had built three of them with his own hands. That was another blow. And then a few weeks later, I received a letter from my British colleagues who had been working, with whom I had been working among the Colorado Indians. I had left all of my Colorado material with these two women. They were not linguists, but I had shown them how to go forward on the foundation that I had done. They wrote to say that all of that language work had been stolen. There were no Xeroxes in those days and no tape recorders. So there were no copies of anything. A murder, a death, a flood, and a robbery. There's that three-letter word always in our minds, isn't there? Why? And the Lord says, trust me. Follow me. One step at a time. I do know what I'm doing. But Amy Carmichael wrote a poem called These Strange Ashes. It was one that had a tremendous influence in my life. It summarizes, encapsulizes everything that I've been trying to say here. But these strange ashes, Lord, this nothingness, this baffling sense of loss, this is what she calls in her poem the sun, and she never wants to use her own name or her own sex even. She always writes in the masculine. But it's as though this man is having a dialogue with God. These strange ashes, Lord, this nothingness, this baffling sense of loss. God's answer is, son, was the anguish of my stripping less upon the torturing cross? Was I not brought into the dust of death, a worm and no man I? Yea, turned to ashes by the vehement breath of fire on Calvary? O son beloved, I think he says to you and me today, O daughter beloved, this is thy heart's desire. This and no other thing follows the fall of the consuming fire on the burnt offering. Go on and taste the joy set high afar. No joy like that to thee. See how it lights the way like some great star. Come now and follow me. If you want to be my disciple, give up your right to yourself. Take up your cross and follow. One other... Do I have 1 minute, Lars? Okay. One other chapel speaker said this to us. If you are going to sing, where he leads me, I will follow. You better be prepared to sing, what he feeds me, I will swallow. And when the Indians presented me with some very odd things to eat, I had to remember that. Will you love him? Will you trust him? Will you praise him? And I would like for us to have that 1 minute now. Bowed heads, closed eyes. Ask the Lord to show you what he wants you to do. Amen.